Welcome to Women Who Move Nations, the podcast about women in transport and mobility. I'm your host, Michelle Batsis, Executive Director of UITP, the International Association of Public Transport here in Australia and New Zealand. We're raising the voices of women for everyone who works in transport and mobility, and particularly any young women listening out there who are early in their transport careers and looking for inspiration. This week, I'm joined by Jess Opetit, Head of Operations at Via Van. Jess, thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We're really excited to have you because, as you know, our series is exploring senior women who are working in public transport and mobility from around the world. So I want to say thanks for coming onto our podcast, but also thanks for supporting what I think we both feel is a really important diversity agenda.
No, I totally agree. I love seeing other passionate women in the public transport space, and so very happy to be here.
Yeah, it's so great. So what I actually like to start with is talking a little bit about your career and hearing from you about your role at VIA and about the future of transport, and also covering what's happening in mobility. And obviously, you know, we're all aware of COVID-19 and the impact that's having around the world and the implications of that, particularly from, you know, the perspective of transport and mobility. So I think we're going to have a great wide-ranging conversation. So let's get started. Can you tell us a bit about your current role and what it's like being the head of operations at VIA Van?
Sure. So I guess VIA, for those of you who are not that familiar, is a technology company that is focused on revolutionizing public mobility. We provide, I guess, technology that helps improve the routing, efficiency, user experience of sort of public transport. And that could be in the form of sort of improving buses, paratransit vehicles, school buses. And I guess I'll go into all of that a little bit more detail later, but I sort of, with that context, I sort of joined Via Van, which is our European entity, almost exactly 3 years ago, when we were sort of at the sort of very beginning stages of Europe. I was actually our first, I think, official hire in our European entity. And over the course of, I guess, the last few years, most of what I've been focusing on is the actual operational component of how this works. So some of that has to do with, you know, a lot of, if we think about it, public transport agencies know that we need to increase the innovation in public transport if we're going to get higher usage, if we're going to convince people away from the private car. But a lot of them aren't exactly sure how to do it, where to do it, how it would work. And so what my team can help with is sort of having a look at sort of some of the challenges they're facing, the areas that they're exploring, and sort of to help them think through that decision with simulations, worked examples, and the like. We also, once we kind of have actually agreed with a public transit agency or operator or local city to actually deploy something, we're sort of the key stakeholder that helps to actually manage the launch process. So working with our tech team, with the partners team on training, on how to understand usage of the app, how to look at our dashboards, how to analyze data, and then all the way from sort of launching until sort of, I guess, the end of the partnership, which hopefully is never. I guess my team is also responsible for sort of helping the partner to understand how to optimize their operations. So looking at data and saying, okay, you guys are obviously very, very well experienced in running public transport. You know, often these are companies that have been, you know, around for years and years and years running public buses, but they haven't really thought through pricing. They haven't really ever had to do sort of marketing on how to acquire users using social, because a lot of this is, you know, apps that are downloaded on phones. They haven't often always thought through like how to optimize like routing, how to make decisions on when and how much to detour, when it's raining versus when it's sunny. And so those sorts of like fairly operational challenges are things that they haven't necessarily thought through, and my team can often provide support there. So it's sort of quite a broad reaching. And sort of most of that is focused on Europe. We also have quite a number of deployments in the Middle East, which my team helps provide operational support for. And so, you know, it's growing, evolving, and incredibly interesting.
That sounds like a really interesting role. And there's so many aspects, actually, to the on-demand operations that you're looking after. So I just want to ask you, I guess, from a broader perspective, about your career, right? Because how did you end up in this role? And I've got to say, I have a bit of a career crush on you. So I know that we haven't met before, but I'm really looking forward to meeting you. But, you know, looking at your background, you know, you studied law and commerce in Melbourne, which is your hometown, which is my hometown as well. And I know that you did an MBA at Harvard, you did a Master's of Law from the Australian National Uni. But then you've ended up working as a lawyer and working at Apple in Singapore. So how did you end up working in transport and mobility and working at VIA?
I think it's a funny response because I think I also often look at people's sort of LinkedIn profiles and career trajectories, and I've done the same for you, and it turns out you were also a lawyer in a former life. And I think everyone kind of feels like each of those steps must have been, you know, very, very well planned out. But the honest truth is that a lot of my career trajectory has happened by luck and sort of by sort of learning from each role and thinking about what would be most interesting in the next role. So I guess without repeating my trajectory exactly, I did start off as a lawyer, then transitioned into management consulting. And ironically, I worked for LEK Australia, which has a very large public transport practice, one that I wasn't actually particularly involved in, but in hindsight wished I had have been. I then went off to business school. And while I was at business school, I became really interested in supply chain and logistics and sort of very, very big data problems and how to optimize for sort of more greater efficiency in what seemed like a very, very complicated part of the global ecosystem. I moved to Singapore post business school, actually largely not so much from planning. This was more I met someone at business school who was French. I was Australian. I didn't feel ready to commit to Europe. He didn't feel ready to commit to Australia. And so Singapore felt like a safe halfway house with plenty of career opportunities. And when I got to Singapore, I decided, given I was obsessed with supply chain, that going to work for the world's biggest and probably most sophisticated supply chain felt like a good decision. And so I joined Apple's headquarters in Asia. And I absolutely loved supply chain. But what I loved about it was more about sort of the complex, trying to kind of figure out how to plan for unpredictable demand levels and sort of the precision needed in order to kind of make fairly large capital intensive decisions in sort of what was often like a pretty unknown future of kind of what demand was going to look like. And so while I did that for a few years, I then decided also for personal reasons to move to London. I was pregnant with my first daughter and kind of felt like we should be close to one of our families, be it mine in Australia or my husband's in Europe. And I think from a career decision point for both of us, London made a little bit more sense. And so I kind of landed in London, honestly, really originally with the intention of staying with Apple and joining their European operation. But in the process of moving, I came across very randomly a job advertisement for VIA. And both of my sisters at the time were living in New York and they had been using our VIA service in New York. And they'd been raving about this random company that was incredibly efficient, in which they kind of paid public transport prices to get in what felt like, you know, a minivan and get taken anywhere in New York. And they're like, oh, if they had this in Melbourne, if they had this in London, it would be so excellent. And when I saw the name, it sort of triggered. I was like, I wonder if that's that same company. And anyway, honestly, I sort of applied on a whim without really thinking it through very heavily. And the people that I met, the vision, the company's founders, who are sort of two of the most passionate and charismatic humans I've ever met, sort of convinced me that this was the company that I wanted to join. And ironically, it had nothing to do with public mobility at the time. It had to do with the fact that this was, you know, a complex data problem, incredibly analytical solution, and similarly trying to forecast, kind of trying to influence heavy public transport infrastructure with unpredictable future demand. And, you know, over the course of the last 3 years, public transport has become become a lot sexier than it was, you know, 5 years ago, you know, with the proliferation of micro-mobility companies and the sharing economy. All of a sudden, everyone's like, oh, I want to be in public mobility. I want to be in public transport. And while, you know, I definitely didn't join for those reasons originally, since joining, I have loved this industry. I think there are so many fascinating ways that we can think about how things should move. You know, there's so many topical concepts around this, be it, you know, the climate emergency and the need to sort of reduce the very, very heavy carbon emissions that come from private
private cars, you know, the increased need for multimodality and connecting different modes of transport. You know, there's just so many interesting concepts that have sort of arisen over the course of the last 5 years in this space. So while I sort of never intended to go into public mobility, or I sort of fell into it by chance, I think given all of the interesting things in this space and given the number of companies and public transport agencies that are really thinking innovatively, I find it hard to believe that I won't remain in public mobility. I just find the broad area just fascinating and sort of a very good example of how data and innovation can really make a huge change and really positively influence an industry.
Yeah, that's so great. I mean, you said a few things there which really stuck out for me, right? One, I love the idea of public transport being sexy. I think that's great, actually. I've never heard that before, but there's definitely something that's happened in the last 5 years, and we've seen this around the world, where public transport is now being seen as really the sustainable solution for the problems we're seeing in cities and the complex problems that need to be solved for customers using technology and data. So, and I'm really keen now to hear a bit more about how you're doing that at VIA. So let's talk about on-demand more broadly. So VIA is a global company with several different operations around the world. And obviously we've heard about New York, as you explained before, which is one of the leading examples that gets touted for on-demand. So could you talk us through the different operations in the UK and what's so special about these operations, right? So what is it that leads them to be seen as great examples of on-demand in operation?
Sure. So I think one of the reasons the UK is a great demonstration of sort of Via Van's product working is because it works in so many different types of environments and with so many different stakeholders. So I guess one of the big things we have going in the UK is we've got very, very strong relationships with a lot of sort of the world's biggest transport operators. So we currently have deployments with Arriva, the Go Ahead Group and Stagecoach, which are kind of seen to be three of the world's premier public bus companies, or actually public transit operators. Similarly, we also have deployments directly with the Transport Authority. So in London, we work with Transport for London, a deployment in Sutton, which is Transport for London's first on-demand bus trial. And that is a fairly good example of us working directly with a very, very large, sophisticated public transport agency. We also have deployments in major cities like London and Liverpool, which are obviously fairly urban and quite dense. But we also have really good examples of deployments in rural environments. So we have an operation in the Tees Valley with Stagecoach, and we have an operation in Sevenoaks in Kent with a smaller public transport operator called GoCoach. And sort of, I think this is a very good example of how on-demand can work both in very, very urban dense cities, but also in more rural types of environments. The UK also provides us with examples of sort of integrating with or improving fixed line route operations. So in the Sevenoaks example that I just referenced, you know, there in the current crisis, we've actually replaced all of the underperforming fixed route bus lines and replaced them with on demand. And there we've seen really impressive examples of, you know, in the right environment where demand drops, the ability of on-demand being able to not only provide a better quality of service than the fixed route bus, because instead of a bus coming around once an hour, you know, anyone that's requesting at any given time can get a proposal for a bus to be there in, you know, 10 to 12 minutes. But also it's sort of in places like that where in order to cover all of the fixed route lines, you need something like 10 buses. In a DRT solution, they've been able to reduce that to, you know, 5 or 6 demand responsive buses, which helps to reduce their fixed cost base in sort of what is currently a pretty challenging time. Another example of sort of a fixed line type of integration we have is in Oxford, where we've got a pretty exciting partnership with the Go Ahead Group. There, the Go Ahead Group actually also runs a number of the fixed route buses in and out of Oxford city centre. And the reason they wanted a demand responsive solution was that on the outskirts, if you wanted to travel around the periphery, the only way to do it on the public bus was to travel into the city centre and back out of the city centre, which was obviously a fairly long detour. And so as a result, most people use their private car. But they were worried about if they introduced a demand responsive transport solution, wouldn't that then take people away from the existing bus network? And so one of the ways we did sort of implemented a solution there was we used pricing as a deterrent for people travelling into and out of the city centre, which they could do via the bus, and sort of instead encouraged the transport trips around the city centre. So, for instance, if you wanted to go take a demand responsive trip that could already be done by the existing public transport network, it would cost 3 or 4 times the amount. Whereas if you wanted to take a trip that wasn't covered by existing public transport, you could do it in demand responsive transport solution at the public transport prices. And so in that scenario, we've really been able to kind of capture the exact demand that we wanted and provide a really good public transport sort of supplement without actually taking away from the existing network. And then finally, in the UK, we've also sort of deployed a number of what we call like sort of our new product lines. And so the one that I'm most excited about and sort of the newest is in the borough of Sutton in London. They were having a struggle at the moment with emergency deliveries. So every Saturday they have something like 100 volunteers dispatching something like 700 emergency parcels to individuals that are forced to self-isolate but don't know anyone who can deliver them food parcels. And so this is sort of a full sort of supported local council initiative to be able to give residents in the Sutton Borough critical food sources during this time of isolation. And we've been able to sort of redeploy what we call our pre-booking product, such that the council can upload all of the deliveries that need to be made in a given day. We've been able to give all of the volunteers apps that they can log into. And then the apps will give each volunteer the exact specifications of what they need to pick up, exactly who they need to drop off to, and provide the council a way to be able to monitor exactly which deliveries were successful, which were unsuccessful, so they have a very good visibility as to which residents still need to be taken care of through the course of the week.
What I've heard from you is actually around how on-demand's being used in the UK. It sounds like to solve different problems, right? And this is what we keep hearing about in on-demand. So there's the first and last mile problem, right? How you're getting to and from the transport hub. But then also the concept around replacing underused or poorly designed bus services. And it sounds actually like there's some great examples of that in the UK, which we haven't seen so much in Australia and New Zealand where I'm based, although certainly there is a trial actually that Via's involved with in New Zealand, where the town's bus services have been replaced with on-demand. So we're very keen to see how that plays out. The other, I guess, idea with on-demand is, you know, how it can be used as a low-cost solution for areas that are underserved by public transport. There's not actually much public transport available in terms of options. So I'm keen just to hear from you, right, around, and maybe you can take a more global perspective, around the kinds of services that on-demand can provide and what kinds of solutions they're providing for customers. But particularly important, and this is for the critics out there as well, how does the business model stack up, you know, in terms of cost per trip and the kind of subsidy that might be required from the local authority? You know, what does that look like and how do you make that work at VIA?
Cool. So I guess a bit to unpack there. I think I'll start with just the different types of business models we have, and I'll give you some coloured examples of sort of some of the things we're doing globally, and then we can get on to sort of the business model question. In terms of like the different things that we do, we've got something like, you know, sort of more than 100 deployments in more than 21 countries globally. And in each city and in each area, obviously public transport is quite personal, and so things need to be adopted to kind of fit the specific use case. In some of the things that we're solving, you know, in places like Berlin, where the city is fairly concerned about one, congestion and passenger miles, but also with sort of carbon emissions, we're sort of powering a pretty substantive fully electric public transport with multimodality options. Our service is called Belkening. It's been pretty successful in its adoption. It had more than 1 million rides in its first year of operation. And it's running with something like 185 vehicles in central Berlin, the majority of which are electric. It's fully wheelchair accessible. It's integrated with the BVG Transit app. And, you know, there where it's really been about reducing passenger miles, we've reduced something like 250,000 private car trips in its first year, which is sort of a pretty big feet.
I think you alluded to sort of another reason that some of these services exist. First mile, last mile is obviously a big one. In order to get people out of the private car, you know, we need to be able to get people to transit hubs and from transit hubs more efficiently. And so in places like Seattle, where we've got a partnership with King County Metro, we're doing exactly that. We're providing pretty cool first mile, last mile solutions such that we can tell people you don't need a car, because every time you need to get somewhere, we know that the train can get you from A to B as efficiently as possible, and you no longer need to drive your car to the station and park there, because there's a very good first mile, last mile solution. In New York City, we've just deployed sort of what we think is probably the world's biggest on-demand responsive type of bus solution. So we are providing sort of full visibility, full routing optimization improvements for New York City school buses. It's something like 9,500 buses doing roughly 150,000 student trips a day. And that's providing sort of real-time tracking of students and buses for parents, for the schools, and really for the city to be able to sort of optimally transport kids around the city to get to school, and sort of to make fleet management and sort of the overall analytics of the service a lot more visible. A similar solution we've sort of deployed in the paratransit space. So for those of you familiar with Dial-A-Ride solutions, they have historically been particularly poor at providing very good customer experience to those that really need good transport solutions. Some of the solutions we look at, sort of passengers that use Dial-A-Ride, kind of get told, we're going to pick you up tomorrow at any time during the day and drop you off tomorrow at any time during the day. And so those people have to sort of sit at home and just wait for a vehicle to pick them up and to drop them off. And it's a pretty poor public transport experience for those that really don't have a lot of other ways of getting around. And so in somewhere like Norfolk, Virginia, where we've taken over their paratransit solution, we're running more than 70 vehicles and doing about 1,000 daily rides. You know, we've been able to kind of improve that experience for the consumer quite drastically by giving them sort of a window of 15 minutes of which they're going to get picked up and 15 minutes from where they're going to get dropped off, and a booking experience that is just a lot more seamless, such that they feel like they're getting the public transport solution that is offered to everyone else. And then I think we've got really good examples of corporate shuttle solutions and fixed route integration solutions and autonomous solutions, which I won't go through in detail, but what I think this helps to paint is that there isn't one solution and there isn't one business model for on-demand. I think on-demand is about improving the public transport experience for users. And so when it comes to the sort of the business model in terms of what it costs, I think it also really depends. So if you look at things like paratransit and school buses, these are always public funded solutions. You know, I don't know a paratransit solution anywhere in the world that is making money or even breaking even. I think what our solution attempts to do is to actually make the costs of this system more efficient by aggregating more effectively, doing better route optimization, to having better trackability as to exactly how many passengers are taking trips per day. And so in those two solutions, the introduction of technology has helped to actually reduce the costs. And I think the same is probably true in the school bus system, where if you're not able to account in real time for students who have changed houses or don't need to travel to school today, the bus is doing unnecessary stops that it wouldn't otherwise have been doing. And then I think in the public transport solution, so the first mile, last mile, and sort of the making sort of the everyday bus on demand, I think that there the spectrum looks fairly similar to public transport. So in places like London, where there's, you know, really strong demand density and there's sufficient demand on a number of key routes for those routes to be more than commercially viable, and for those routes in some instances to actually subsidize other parts of the public transport network. That is also true of on-demand. You know, if you put on-demand solutions in the most, you know, heavily aggregated, very, very urbanly dense environments, you know, we look at our New York City solution, we look at our sort of London operations, it's very clear to be totally commercially viable as an on-demand solution. I think what often happens is that people come to us and they say, hey, we really want to provide on-demand in rural communities where the existing public transport infrastructure doesn't work and can't be commercially viable. And in places like that, the introduction of on-demand can help to reduce the overall costs of operating the service, but it's very unlikely that you're going to be able to make a rural environment without a huge amount of demand all of a sudden commercially viable by making it on-demand. And so I think that is my answer to that. There isn't one set business model. In some business businesses, the service can be commercially viable. In other businesses, it requires public subsidy, but I don't think it looks any different to existing public transport solutions. My thoughts on it, it just provides a better customer experience than a lot of the existing public transport solutions.
Yeah, and that's really true, right? Actually, I mean, there's not many examples in the world where you see public transport that doesn't have a subsidy attached to it, right? So it's actually very difficult to make public transport commercially viable. So, you know, I think that's actually super interesting and helpful, Jess, just understanding the complexities of what's involved in thinking through the business models for on-demand. So I'd like to now shift to talking about COVID-19 and the implications that's having on public transport and mobility, and specifically what you've seen in the operations at VR. So have you seen trends in terms of travel behavior and ridership and customer impacts? And also, what's your thinking in terms of how you optimize the on-demand solutions, you know, going into the recovery phase and the new normal?
It's a very good question. I think obviously transport has been drastically impacted by COVID-19, and that obviously includes the demand responsive transport sector. You know, when people are asked to stay at home, obviously the transport sector is impacted. And I think, you know, if you look at some of the Google graphs of like mobility changes over pre and post COVID-19, you know, 80 to 90% reductions in public transport usage are pretty commonly now seen across most major global cities, which kind of I find mind blowing. And I think, you know, that obviously has had some level of impact on demand responsive transport. But I think one of the things that a lot of our partners have very quickly come to see is actually demand responsive transport is likely to play a pretty important role both during and after the crisis for a number of reasons. So I think in the first reason, if you want to be able to sort of stop public transport across the city, but only open it up to critical workers, you're going to need some form of technology that allows you to, one, validate whether someone is a critical worker and traveling for a valid reason. You're also likely to going to need some way to be able to sort of limit the trips that these people can do. So in a number of our deployments globally, we've sort of introduced sort of a validation at the front, which allows a hospital worker to put in their hospital ID or to put in some form of credentials that allows our system to validate that they are indeed a critical worker. Separately, we've sort of been able to sort of do what we call polygon blockers. And in layman's term, what that means, it means that we are only allowing trips that are sort of being requested from a specific area to a hospital or a GP clinic or a sort of key point of interest and vice versa, which means not only are we able to sort of control the types of people that are using the service, but then also what they're using the service for. And it's very difficult for cities to be able to provide key transport workers sort of public transport without some level of intervention like this, unless they are going to completely change their sort of fixed route offering, which, just for those of you in the public transport sector will know, is very, very time consuming and difficult to do. So I think that's something that's kind of we've been able to sort of clearly help with in sort of the immediate. And I think one of the things that we're sort of looking at as we kind of emerge from the post COVID-19 and sort of get to, I think we're going to be a very, very far cry away from normal, but like what we'll call the new normal or the intermediate normal, is that there are a few things that people are really going to care about. I think one is safety. So how do we make sure that, you know, the very, very heavily tracked like bus routes are not overcrowded and we're able to actually implement social distancing on these buses? How do we make sure that if someone comes into contact with someone who traveled with them and they know that that person, you know, a few days later was found out to be positive, how do we contract trace very, very quickly and notify everyone else that was in the vehicle that someone on that vehicle has tested positive and that they should probably self-isolate for the next 14 days? How do we do payment integration such that people don't have to touch the drive or a handover payment and there's kind of a way to have some form of like limit? And I think the more of these sorts of examples we look at, like some form of technology and tracking and demand responsive transport type solution is probably going to be pretty critical to getting people to feel safe to be using public transportation again.
Yeah, great. I mean, safety is definitely one of the key considerations, right? Particularly in the post COVID-19 phase. I think what's really interesting as well is that while transport and mobility is being impacted, it's also going to be a key part of the solution as the economy is opened back in different cities and regions around the world. And certainly we can see that on-demand actually is becoming a permanent solution in the mix of options that transport planners can be looking at for how they get people to move around cities. So I just have a couple more questions more broadly now around mobility and also about diversity in the sector. So in terms of mobility, more broadly than on-demand, what are your favorite innovations in mobility at the moment? You know, in the position you have at VIA, you know, you're based in London, but you're looking after Europe. You have access to what's going on around the world in all sorts of cities. So is there anything that you're seeing or cities that you're looking at who you think are doing an excellent job of innovating in transport?
So this is a purely like personal love, but I'm a big electric bike fan. I actually recently purchased a cool product called Cowboy, which is sort of this young electric bike startup based out of Belgium. And one of the things I sort of really love about Europe is the number of cities where, you know, bike riding and sort of bike pathways has been just sort of made so easy such that it becomes sort of the most obvious transportation of choice. And I think in order to do that well, there are a few things that have to happen. I think one is that cities really have to sort of push that idea of multimodality and sort of set up the system, the city's infrastructure, such that there is really only room for two types of public transport. One is sort of bikes and the other is public transport. And I think, you know, you have to be have sort of pretty bold leaders to sort of say we're getting rid of the private car and we're going to be sort of actioning it pretty explicitly in the way that we design our roads. And so I'm a big fan of cities like Amsterdam, where, you know, bike riding has really become a sort of an integral part of the way that the city moves. And I think electric bikes for me are a good way of sort of pushing people in that direction. In terms of like other cities doing an excellent job, you know, I spent 3 years living in Singapore, and I think it's a pretty incredible city when it comes to congestion management and efficient public transport. You know, there they've just explicitly minimized private car usage by making it very, very expensive to drive a private car. And when everyone else is forced to use public transport, the usage of public transport goes up, the amount of funding therefore in public transport goes up, and you're able to provide just a much better public transport experience. And so to me, like, I know that they've got slightly different, you know, infrastructure in the way that they make decisions, but they're sort of obviously a country and city that can kind of look out 20 or 30 years and optimize for the future. And living there in terms of public transportation and getting around was a dream.
I can only imagine. Every time I visited Singapore, I'm just so amazed by how fantastic their transport system is. And, you know, they've really put such an incredible framework in place and really used policy levers to achieve a really high uptake in public transport use. Thanks, Jess. That was great to hear, I guess, what you're seeing in the world. And certainly with bikes, you know, I think actually that the post-COVID-19 world presents a lot of opportunity for cities and countries to look at how they can actually entice people to take much more active transport options. Because as we all know, we want to be moving people and not cars, right? We're pro public transport. So, you know, the worst outcome we could see from this is actually more congestion on our roads. So Jess, I just wanted to ask you finally, you know, in terms of female leaders in the sector, it's no secret there aren't that many senior females working in public transport and mobility around the world. And we see that when you go to conferences and events, event programs, but also just, yeah, the voices and faces that you see, right? Which is a key reason why we wanted to do this podcast. So I'm just keen to hear from you. Do you have any ideas about how we can see more senior women working in transport and also develop a pipeline of talent?
Yeah, so no, I think you hit the nail on the head. I think it comes down to sort of just a lack of role models in this space. I think the more women, the more, I guess, examples of successful women to aspire to is sort of the way that you're going to attract more females into the space. And I'm sort of one with you. The number of panels I've been asked to speak on just because all of the other panelists were men is sort of mildly alarming. But I think the one thing that I would say is positive is that I think things are slowly starting to change. And I think actually a lot of the tech mobility companies have sort of been leading the way here. And a lot of them have been sort of attracting senior women. And I think for me, at least, you know, when I look at VIA and our ecosystem, you know, we have a female CFO, a female head of legal, a female head of partner success, a female head of the Germany, a female head of the UK. I think, you know, gender, you know, it's one of the gender equality and sort of the way in which female leaders were treated at VIA is definitely one of the reasons I've loved working here, and definitely one of the reasons that I was attracted to working here. But I also see, like, as we go out to recruit, a lot of now, you know, young women are coming in who are incredibly bright and incredibly passionate. And when they talk to me about, like, why they decided to join, a lot of it was like, oh, I was interviewed by so many impressive female women that it kind of inspired me to want to join. And so I think that has to be the way forward. And the only way for that to happen is for us to start kind of, you know, forcing more women up the pipeline and getting more people to stay in the industry.
Yeah, great. So true. I mean, do you have any career advice for any younger women listening out there?
So I think for me, I like always kind of harp on to about the same advice. And I think that, like, too many people, and women in particular, you know, obsess about the destination rather than enjoying the journey. Like, I can recall people at university who were deciding, like, what companies to join or what professions to pursue based on how easy it would be to juggle kids. And many of these women were, like, at least 10 years away from actually having kids. And, like, most of the women who opted for jobs they thought would suit their lifestyle in 10 years' time just didn't enjoy the job, and not surprisingly stopped working well before it, you know, and sometimes when they had kids, but often type like well before that stage. And I think the people who choose work based on what they're passionate about, what excites them, you know, they eventually, you know, have kids or have families, and they just figure out how to make it work. And those people end up loving the journey, and I think continuing to stay inspired. And so when people ask me, like, sort of, how do they, you know, how do you find your path? It's not like I said, okay, I really want to work at VIA in 10 years time, and I really want to lead expansion or operations in Europe, and I really like public mobility. You know, it was just every job I had, I really liked the job. I really liked part of it. It made me, you know, the intellectual stimulation made me work harder and made me want to do the next thing. And the next thing got more exciting and more challenging and more interesting. And it kind of, I think, becomes sort of a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. And so, yeah, I guess I'd encourage all young women to be, like, open-minded, to go with their gut and to find work that really inspires and excites them today without worrying too much about what today, whether today is going to lead them to where they want to be tomorrow. If they love what they do today, I promise they will get to where they want to be tomorrow.
That's great advice, Jess, and super inspiring as well. Thank you so much. It's been fantastic to hear your thoughts and insights, and look forward to seeing you in the future at a UITP Global Summit event.
Thank you so much for having me, and I'm looking forward to that too.
That's all we have time for. I'd like to say to all of our listeners, thank you for listening, and look forward to having you join us for future podcasts. Thank you to everyone for listening to this week's episode of Women Who Move Nations. This series is co-produced by Cassandra Kadelka and Lara Rudd, with copywriting by Sophia Dickinson. Please join us each week as we raise the voices of women in the public transport and mobility sector. I'm Michelle Batsis. Keep safe and keep our nations moving.